97.9 FM and 1360 AM WCHL and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, college athletes and how they compare to non-athletes on campus. Our guest, Brad Wolverton, former senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, now writing for NerdWallet. So Brad, after having written for a long time about nerds with nothing in their wallets, covering higher education, so that's the end of the bad jokes for today. Let's talk about what's different about college athletes and non-athletes on campus. One would be the amount of time that they have to put into their, quote, job being an athlete.
You know, absolutely. Well, thanks for having me, Charlie. It's really a pleasure to join you. Big fan of your work. And you're right. There are lots of, I don't know if they're nerds, but there's certainly lots of jocks with not a lot of money in their pocket. It always amazes me how much college athletes come to college, you know, sometimes not prepared academically, but from such a lower rung of the economic ladder that they really need spending money and they're just in a different class. And they certainly spend a whole lot more time on their sport than you can even imagine. I mean, on average, it's like 40 hours a week is what they self-report spending. And that's where it really starts, the difference between what's, you know, a normal student and a college athlete. It begins as early as 5:30, 6 in the morning, and sometimes doesn't end until, you know, middle of the night when they take their bus rides back to campus. So you see these kids on the field and you see them shining in March, you know, and in their championship seasons, which you start to see now with lots of the spring sports coming to a close. But you don't see the vast number of hours they put in. I mean, they pack their classes in, a few classes in the morning, and by right after lunchtime, they're on their sport. They're doing practices. They're doing lifting. They're back to training tables. And they spend the better part of their days actually working on refining their craft on the field and in the courts and in the pools. And then they try to cram in as many hours as they can at night to study and catch up. So it's really like a full-time load, and they just do it every day. It's pretty amazing.
All right, so let's talk about the hours spent. They self-report. There are lots of studies that show that athletes self-report 40 hours. Many people say it's really more like 60, but the NC2A has a 20-hour limit. So where does this come into play, this 20-hour limit?
It's really a farce because we all know that these athletes spend far more than 20 hours a week on their sport. There are limits on, I mean, it would be too hard for me to get into all the weird NCAA definitions of what actually counts and what's not a countable athletic hour. But suffice to say that the NCAA has kind of obfuscated the hours here. It basically makes it look like they're really not spending that many hours on their sport. So many things don't count. So basically, they're only allowed to compete and spend a certain number of hours. But like, say, for instance, they only count 3 hours when they play athletic competitions. And we all know that for, say, a football game day, I mean, I used to work in sports information when I was in college. And so I'd get to the football stadium, you know, several hours before the game, and I'd leave several hours after the game. Well, the athletes, their day extends even beyond that, but they only count 3 hours of that toward the competition. And a lot of times when you go on the road, it's not just like taking charter flights like you might do at UNC for basketball, but you've got the volleyball team and the tennis team, and they're in vans and they're driving lots of places. So there are 6 or 7 hour drives just to get there, but those hours don't count either. So it's really kind of a joke how the system works that way. But they do spend seriously at least 40 hours, and probably during certain seasons, they spend 50, 60 hours a week on their sport only. So it is really like a full-time job.
So what athletes have said in response to various surveys is, number one, we want 2 days off per week. You know, most Americans get 2 days off per week, and they don't want travel to count as an off day. That seems very reasonable.
It really is reasonable, and I'm not sure why the NCAA and why the schools can't get together and give these kids a break, because they are bringing in lots of money for the institutions, and their bodies, by the time they get to college, are pretty tired. They're broken down from having trained since they were 5, 6 years old. I mean, I have kids who play travel sports now myself, and it's amazing. Like, my daughter's 8 years old, and she practices and plays soccer 6 days a week, and it's a little nuts. I mean, if you're good at it, and if you like it, and you're seeing a social benefit from it, that's great. But by the time you get to college, you have lots of kids who are injured and tired, and then they're exhausted, and they also have serious study demands. So they need that time off. But it's not something that, even despite all the changes the NCAA has made recently to appease athletes, they haven't really given them enough of a breather on the schedules.
Okay, Brad, so here's a theory. Tell me what you think of it. The reason that individual universities wouldn't do something like this is because they fear it would put them at a competitive disadvantage. So you're not going to unilaterally disarm, knowing that your competitors are not going to do that. So it would take a massive group effort, if you will, to make something like this come to be.
It would, but it just takes common sense too, because it's like you're starting to see some of these coaches. I mean, surprisingly, in certain high-profile leagues, some of the coaches, they do work like nuts. The hours are crazy, but during the summers, more of them are starting to take two weeks, 3 weeks off. And these are some of the biggest, best programs. And I won't even say their names because they don't want me to use their names. But I do think you're starting to see some little cracks in the system. But that's an example that benefits the coaches. I don't think the coaches, unfortunately, are taking those same measures to benefit the players. You're going to see a coach that could make a good name for him or herself by publicly making it clear that they're going to do that, and they're going to give their kids that extra time. You've started to see in this new NCAA system where leagues, say the Pac-12 is going to do a certain thing, or the Big Ten is going to do a certain thing with maybe practicing less days a week with contact in football, or the Ivy League's been really good at that, and the Big Ten has made some steps toward making improvements in that area. But I think until a coach sees that another coach is getting an advantage out of recruiting, and by saying, hey, we're not going to train as much, we're going to let our kids be fresher for competition. Why not? Overtraining is not doing anybody any favors. And it's, unfortunately, that message hasn't gotten through to a lot of college coaches.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion with Brad Wolverton about the state of college athletics and how athletes are treated compared to non-athletes. So, Brad, one more quick question about the time constraint. So one of the other things that athletes have said in the revenue sports have said, in addition to wanting 2 days off a week and don't count travel as a day off, we want two weeks at the end of the season, because athletes will tell you there is no off season these days.
There really isn't. I mean, it's a year-round schedule. It used to be that, as kids growing up, you'd see, you could play a sport in the spring, a sport in the summer, something in the fall and the winter. You'd play four sports a year and you'd feel refreshed and excited to try those new sports. Now, if you're good at swimming, you literally can't get out of the pool. I mean, if you spend more than a day out of the pool, then you see yourself as like getting behind on things. I think the answer that most college athletic directors would give to that question is the vast majority of programs do give kids 2 weeks off after the season. It's not that unusual. And I don't disagree with that. I think that's likely the case. But what exactly is off these days? I mean, having time off, you're supposed to not, if you're in NCAA sports, you're not really allowed to have contact with your players during off seasons like the summer. Well, you still manage to have these practices, and kids are all staying for summer schedules. They literally are there year round because they have to train and go to the weight room and all this. They do get a little bit of time off after the season, but they still practice, a little bit, at least every couple of days. It's not mandated by the coach, but it's more or less seen as mandatory because coaches do, keep track of who's at those practices. So, I mean, it is unfortunate that there's so much focus on, making sure kids play and compete and are there and available. But I think people see it as a positive for some of these athletes, where if they went back home, they might get into trouble. They might start running around with kids that aren't looking out for them. And so keeping them on campus can both keep them on track toward getting their degree faster and keep them out of trouble.
All right. So that's a nice transition, because I want to spend the rest of our time talking about such a young man who, you know, had he gotten off campus, you know, they're worried about what might happen to him. And just in general, an article you wrote called The Education of Desmond Cathy. Young man who saw school as a needless burden, even when he was in grammar school, hadn't read a book by the time he got to high school, and yet, you know, gets an athletic scholarship to play football. What more can you tell us about Desmond Cathy and what he represents?
This story was one of the most meaningful experiences of my career. He's one of the sweetest individuals I've ever met, and, you know, really a person who literally, I think, was born to take care of other people. At least he grew up in a really challenging environment, you know, West Memphis, where there was just literally lots of gun violence and lots of drugs and gangs. And he avoided a lot of those temptations because he was a talented athlete. But he also helped out a lot of kids who were running around in those gangs. And, you know, he found himself in compromised situations all the time. And his ticket out, like a lot of these kids, was playing college sports. And he goes and plays football at the University of Memphis. At the time, was a pretty low-rung program. And he basically did, you know, he took his pocketed his room and board money, and he lived on people's couches, so that he could, you know, take that money and give it to his family to help them pay their bills. And, you know, I think what he represents is he's certainly not the norm, but he literally came to college without an ability to really read. And I think he was not diagnosed with a learning disability, maybe. He was somebody who was basically passed through at every level of education. And then he gets to college, and somehow, without being able to really even read, teaches himself through teaching with these little learn to read books, how to start from the beginning and learn how to read. And he manages, with the help of a miraculous athletic academic support program, which is like one of the most under talked about things, but one of the most important ways that many of these kids get through college, is you have a lot of tutors and academic advisors who prop the kids up. And that's what happened at Memphis. It happens everywhere, where, you know, you see at UNC the what can happen with that. But I think this is a much broader issue than the problems that were talked about at UNC, because it's literally you are doing a lot. You're really doing more than handholding. You're in some cases doing the work for these kids. But I think eventually Desmond Cathy is a great example of how to, he ends up using the system to get himself through college, and he ends up graduating, getting a degree first in his family to do so. And I think the big question is, was he better off after all of that? And I think in the end, because he has a degree, he's going to be somewhere better off. But I think ultimately, you know, I think 4 years later, 5 years later now, Desmond, you know, when we left Desmond last time, he had 6 credits left, and he finally finished his degree. And now he's, you know, he's still trying to play arena football, and he's working at a gym and trying to be a personal trainer. So at least he's made something of his life. But it's in some ways a sad story, but in some ways a positive story about how kids can, you know, from those tougher backgrounds, can get access to higher education through athletics. But he's an example of somebody who had to persist and teach himself a whole lot more than most kids.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Brad Wolverton about the state of college athletics and how young men typically, get sort of pushed through the system. We were talking about Desmond Cathy, and you wrote a very nice long article about him. The key question for me, Brad, is how many Desmond Cathys are there?
I think what I found was that an academic director of an academic support program at a major university in the Big Ten, who said to me, you know, we were all sort of scared when that story came out, because it could have been any of us. We all have our Desmond Cathy. And I think that signaled to me that there were kids in every top program that had either severe learning disabilities or severe, you know, deficiencies in academic preparation for college. That means I don't think there are that many of those kids out there. I think there are a select few in big programs, but it's pretty startling that, you know, if you have kids who are reading at third and fourth grade levels, but you have kids who are literally just, it's not even not being able to read. It's the ability to comprehend and to do more complex reasoning and math skills. And so just, they're just unprepared. So unfortunately, many colleges have now started to test for learning disabilities and deficiencies so that they know coming in what they're working with and they know how to help those kids. And many of these kids are honestly, you may think they're not smart, but they are actually really smart. I mean, Dasmin and many of the kids that I've met who come in really unprepared are some of the smartest kids you could meet. They're well-spoken. They, you know, if you can read a college football playbook and go out on a field and do some of the things you have to do by reading those playbooks, you're a pretty smart person. So there are good signs that if you take these kids in and you know what their deficiencies are coming in, you can help them and you can prepare them for a different kind of life.
Sure. However, there are programs that channel these kids into less rigorous tracks. They wind up, as Dasmin did, taking beginning tennis twice. I don't know how you get the same course twice, but this seems to be more prevalent than it should be, that they get pushed through the system.
They don't really have much choice. And the surveys the NCAA does show that the athletes report themselves saying that if they weren't athletes, they would have taken different classes and different majors. I mean, you have to take classes at certain times of the day. You have to, you know, you're told basically, you know, if you want to be an engineering student or if you want to go into something where you have to do training in the afternoon and go to a labs or something, forget it because that's when practice is. And so you are pushed into certain majors, and that's not good. You know, you end up, I think you should do what you like in life. And what they're being told is you like sports and you want to get here, you want to go to college for free and get this education for free, then you're going to have to just basically track into these certain areas that are going to make that path easier so that you can stay eligible to help us make a bunch of money.
So we were at a conference recently together, and one of the one of your fellow panelists said, I won't even use the term student athlete. I'll call them college athletes because many of them are not students first, and some of them don't care about being students at all. So how do we correct the narrative if indeed we need to?
Oh, I don't think there's I would agree with that. I've never really thought that there's a lot of them are not there to be students. I mean, it depends on how you classify college athletes. Many of them are not your TV football and basketball players. I mean, the vast majority are in sports that are not nearly as high profile, and there are some amazing students in college sports, and college sports gives you an ability to discipline yourself and, you know, and do well in school. And but the people that bring in the money that we're talking about, that are the ones we always write about, are certainly in need of a different path. And I don't know if that means that we give them the chance to major in things that they're going to actually use later in life. Like maybe they want to go into coaching. And so we allow them to have majors in athletic performance in different ways and learn about physiology and have a more rounded education that actually prepares them for jobs like Dasmin now has in the athletic training world. You know, you'd see that in music and in other fields where you come in and it's a performance degree more than it is. I mean, I as a journalist, I learned how to write about, you know, write news stories. And I think that there's an education that you get that's part craft. And in sports, you could probably see, you know, you could probably do better for these kids than just making them take multicultural classes and these classes that they're not necessarily going to use as much. I do think we have to be serious about the fact that this is education still. And if you are going to claim that we are about, you know, more than sports, then you should be required, like any other student, to get a diverse education and not just making sure that you know how to take tennis two times and pass it and get an A in that class.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Brad Wolverton, Thanks also to producers Caleb Waters and Rachel Scott. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.